We have time for a few more questions here. Then it's going to be my son's bedtime and mine as well. Let's go down here front.
Senator,
yes, sir.
We've got it.
Hello, Dave. I've heard that the Lysander was called the first stealth plane. Why was that?
Stealth?
The first stealth plane, right?
I'll be right back.
Well, I don't know if you'd call it stealth, although it certainly is a quiet airplane. It flies at a low power setting. It would certainly take off and land in very short distances and very rough fields. It is really quite good at that. The one I was flying didn't have very good brakes. And the more I researched, I realized, well, they didn't have very good brakes in World War II, and no matter what we do, they're not very good now either. So I often taxi, I landed on infields and landed on taxiways, and if there was a bad crosswind, I couldn't turn, against it. I would do a 270 around the airfield this way to get to my destination. Very robust airplane. You could take it pretty much through any kind of rough horse pasture grass and that sort of thing. It would appear in places you wouldn't expect it.
I see. Hey, group captain, you had something to add.
Yeah, I think maybe that story comes from the job that the aircraft did in the Second World War.
The nighttime flying.
Nighttime flying. Yes, they were painted black, and they took secret agents into occupied territory, and chiefly in France and Belgium. And they would, as you say, they would land on very short strips, rough fields that have been prepared literally minutes before by the resistance fighters, land very short, drop off an agent, pick up one who was coming home, and take off again, and ride under the noses of the enemy and not be seen or heard. So that's probably where that reference comes from.
All right. So I think we have time for maybe one more. Let's see.
I have a gentleman
yes, sir.
Here in the front.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Is that Richard?
It is Richard.
It is.
Oh, my goodness. We should have had Richard up here tonight, too. Richard Wilshire, everyone.
There's no point spoiling the event.
Yeah.
if I might first offer a comment to the question about the noise of a Vulcan, maybe you missed the B-1 this morning. the question is, though, and I'll focus it on Group Captain Richards, though you might all have an opinion, which of those aircraft operated by the Royal Air Force would you believe or consider to have the longest operational service time?
That's a good question. I think it would be potentially the Canberra, which came into service, as we heard, I believe early 50s. It was operational during the Suez Crisis, which we don't talk about. And then right the way through to retirement, I think 2005 or maybe 2006. So you can do the maths, but that's a long time as an operational aircraft. And of course, started off as a bomber, as we heard, and then finished off as a photo reconnaissance aircraft. Did some amazing work over Afghanistan, but I think eventually it just had to be retired. So I hope that's correct. Someone can correct me.
I can correct.
But I think that's the right answer.
I've heard on the Canberra, this is for those of you that know anybody that has flown one. I've talked to a number of people that flew back in this time in the U.S., and apparently there was a program for a little while where U.S. pilots, and I've only met three or four of these guys, who learned how to fly the Canberra. And every one of these guys, you go into their garage, and there in the garage is the yoke from a Canberra. And you're like, what is this? And they're like, well, I learned to fly the Canberra. And it's so hard that they gave them the yoke that they learned in. A very difficult airplane, from what I'm told.
It was. And tragically, we lost a lot of crews doing things like practice asymmetric, so one engine approaches and landings. It took us a long time to learn that maybe we shouldn't practice them because they were so dangerous. And I have colleagues who would literally show me the scars on their back from ejecting from a Canberra. It wasn't an easy airplane to fly.
And of course, as we said earlier, the jet version of the Mosquito, which is kind of a neat idea. I walked by, and I saw a lady walk by Kermit's Mosquito that's out here, and that's a beautiful airplane. In fact, she smoked a cigarette after she passed by it. But it's a gorgeous airplane with such wonderful lines. Competes, in my opinion, with the F7F. Dave is now laughing, so there we go.
It's the only airplane I've flown where the last item on the checklist is you try and get the termites to all hold hands.
Yeah, that's right. Well said. Well, folks, I hope you've enjoyed tonight. We have one, I believe, and two more, which and then we're going to get out of here tonight and all go to another campfire. But let's go back to the back here.
Senator.
Thank you for being here. I believe NASA is flying some Canberras currently. They were used to photograph the eclipse we had here just a few months ago. Well, my question is, what impact do you believe that the supermarine racing of the 1930s had on British aircraft development?
That's a wonderful question. I'm not sure who wants to take it. There's every one of these folks could answer that one.
It had a phenomenal effect. R.J. Mitchell's work on the Supermarine S6B and the S6A really paved the way for the Spitfire. Likewise, the work that Rolls-Royce did on the engine, the Type R, paved the way for the Kestrel, which became the Merlin. If we hadn't competed in the Schneider Trophy in early 1930s, we wouldn't have had a Spitfire. Without the Spitfire, would we have won the Battle of Britain? It's debatable. Yes, the Hurricane did a lot of work. The Spitfire did a lot, but the Spitfire really won the public's admiration. It was whoever was the PR manager for the Supermarine Spitfire did the job. It was a propaganda tool that really pulled a nation together. So irrespective if you look at the statistics of how many Spitfires shot aeroplanes down compared to others, the Spitfire gelled the nation together. It was the Spitfire that enabled people to go out and cut down the iron railings to melt down to make into Spitfires. Didn't matter what they were made into, but people thought they were going into a Spitfire. So yes, without the Schneider Trophy, we would probably not have got as far into World War II as we did.
Yeah, Dave, you had something to add to that, I believe?
It's also the design team that turned out the Supermarine 6B racer learned from that victorious experience that they could do just about anything. You know, that was the cutting edge of fuel technology, supercharging, cooling, and the whole thing was a flying radiator, flight controls, interface with a pilot, that everything was right at the very limit of what they could do, and then they won. And then, of course, when the war clouds were gathering shortly after, they realized they could turn out both an engine and an airframe that was a world beater.
I think that's been great. Now, I want to point something out tonight about this crowd, because they have hung in here. They've asked all these questions. We've had a great time tonight. At least I have. I hope they have. But the stories that we tell on this stage are perpetuated by all of us, including you. And I know Richard's here tonight, Wilshire, and I bring this up because EAA and what we're doing here at AirVenture is synonymous with storytelling and preserving this and inspiring kids like down in the front row there, my son, who's six and still up to hear all of this. But Richard has, in my opinion, one of the most historic British airplanes that is here at Oshkosh. He has a de Havilland Chipmunk that was part of only two. There were two that flew around the world at the end of the Chipmunk time in the RAF. One, of course, is in the Royal Air Force Museum. The other is here at Oshkosh, tucked away without a sign on it. And Richard keeps this thing. And I say this, don't take offense, Richard. But Richard keeps this thing as it came off the line. I mean, it's truly bone stock, and it's magnificent to see. It still has everything in it, and it's just as it was the day they finished it. So it's not one that is shiny and polished up. It's truly original, and that's what you do here at AirVenture. You keep these memories alive and these stories alive, and I hope tonight that we have done a small part in perpetuating the stories of the RAF and telling this story. Did we do a good job for you? Should we put this thing to bed? Group Captain, are you satisfied with this? Are we good? Thank you for being here, all of you. To Dave Hatfield, who's going to be back here on Thursday night, and we also have another little question here.
Can we do one final question? We can do a final question.
Does he bring this young man up here, though, if he's going to come up? Come on up. And tell everybody your name down here when we come up, because this is what it's all about right here. Look at this guy. He's been here all night. What's your question? Did you have a good time tonight? I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but come on up here. What's your question? It's okay. You want to just tell me?
What was the last airplane you flew?
That's a great question.
Great question. I have to think quite hard about that. I think the last airplane I flew was a Hawk. You know what a Hawk is? A little two-seat trainer, fast jet. That's the last aircraft I flew, and it was fantastic. Maybe one day you'll fly one too. All right?
Are you looking forward to that? Are you going to be a pilot someday, you think? Hopefully, right? Thanks for coming up. Folks, that's what it's all about here tonight. I really hope you'll come back tomorrow night, because tomorrow night here on this stage we will have the Founders Prize awarded. That's at 8 o'clock. For those of you who have not been following the Founders Innovation Prize, this is the pioneering spirit of EAA. I mean, this is where the rubber meets the road, and it's sort of like Shark Tank. These guys are going to come out, they're going to pitch the idea, and at the end of the night, we will have the Founders Innovation Prize awardee, and that's going to be tomorrow night right here. Now, Dave is going to come back. He's a singer. Did you know that? Right. He's an artist and a musician. He's bigger than Taylor Swift is in the U.S. up in Canada. They just, well, you said it. No, they just flocked to see this guy. It's incredible. So he and his brother, Chris Atfield, who's also an aviator and an astronaut, for those of you that don't have been living under a rock, perhaps, for some time, but they're going to come back and they're going to perform for us on Thursday night right here at Theater in the Woods after we do some more talking. So thank you so much. And to you, Group Captain Stevens, thank you for being here.
Pleasure.
We hope you go home with lots of great memories from AirVenture.
And thank you.
Kermit Weeks, ladies and gentlemen. Who, I mean, what else do we need to say? Can we bring the house lights up, though? And all take a selfie with a curfew, as they call it, right? He's invented his own acronym.
Can you
take it? How should we do this? And to Stephen Bridgewater, Lord Bridgewater, thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure.
And you are a sport for wearing your Freddie Mercury shorts here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to depart, and everybody just stand up and wave as Kermit takes his picture here. I don't know how we're going to do this. Let's all get in here. No, Kermit, we got to take it the other way, though.
Oh, the other way.
We're going to take it so all these people can be in it. Here we go. Ready, everybody? All get in close.
If you can see yourself, you got it. Okay, ready? Here we go.
Everybody wave.
Awesome,
there we
guys.
Go.
Good.
Thanks for being here tonight, everybody. Have a safe walk home. So long now.
Good to see you.
Bye. Yeah, good to see you.
Kermit, thank you.